You are tuned into the Dr. Tina Show with Dr. Tina Moore. For more, visit drtina.com. On this episode of the Dr. Tina Show, I'm going to be diving into a few of the blatant, bold untruths that are currently going around about Ozempic, Wegovy, Mounjaro, and other GLP-1 agonists that you are probably hearing about. They are factually incorrect, and I'm going to share with you why. Try as I might, I still find it hard to hit my protein macro goals every day. I also want to optimize my cognition as much as possible because menopause brain is real. Getting adequate protein in is a non-negotiable as we age, and there's a lot of data supporting creatine's use as well. Everything from protecting muscle and improving strength to protecting cognitive function. So I've been taking Momentous protein powder and creatine daily to ensure that all of my bases are covered. These two supplements support nearly every aspect of my foundational health goals, from aiding my cognitive function to supporting my muscles and joints. My Momentous daily protocol has become a staple and makes the perfect addition to the other wellness products that are part of my daily stack. My trust is in Momentous because of their dedication to working with the best, from their collaboration with experts to their unparalleled commitment to using only the highest quality ingredients. They also heavily invest in third-party testing, holding their products to the standards set by the most demanding organizations and ensuring that what's on the label is what's in the product. They call it the Momentous Standard, and it's the industry's leading standard in quality. I'm really digging this daily combo, and if you'd like to check it out yourselves, head to livemomentous.com to get up to 32% off your first subscription order. And if you don't feel like subscribing, you can still get 15% off all my favorite products with the code Dr. Tina, DRTYNA. That's livemomentous.com with code Dr. Tina. Have you heard about senolytics yet? It's a class of ingredients discovered less than 10 years ago, and they're being called the biggest discovery of our time for promoting healthy aging and enhancing your physical prime. Sign me up, right? The aging process is no joke when it comes to maintaining energy and productivity. That's why I've started using Qualia Senolytic. If someone would have told me that there are science-backed ingredients that could help me feel 15 years younger in a matter of months, I would have been on this a long time ago. So here's the deal. As we age, everyone accumulates senescent cells in their bodies. These cells are like browning leaves on a plant. They still suck up energy and resources, but they don't contribute to the health of the plant. They cause the symptoms of aging, and they can turn other nearby cells senescent. Much like pruning the yellowing and dead leaves off the plant, Qualia Senolytic removes the worn-out senescent cells to allow for the rest of our cells to thrive in the body. And you take it just 2 days a month. The formula is non-GMO, vegan, gluten-free, and the ingredients are meant to complement one another, factoring in the combined effect of all the ingredients together. Plus, it has a 100-day money-back guarantee. For me personally, I'm experiencing improved energy levels and productivity, as well as having less aches and pains. Qualia Senolytic is definitely going to be part of my monthly routine going forward. If you also want to resist aging at the cellular level, try Qualia Senolytic. Go to neurohacker.com/Dr. Tina for up to $100 off and use Dr. Tina at checkout for an additional 15% off. That's neurohacker.com/DRTYNA for an extra 15% off your purchase. And thanks to Neurohacker for sponsoring today's episode. Full disclosure, I am not working for Big Pharma, nor am I trying to argue the opposite of what some folks are saying about how Ozempic is being handled on, you know, the big level, as far as it being sort of a global takeover, lots of people taking it, Medicare talking about covering it. I don't think this is the solution to our metabolic problem. I think the large majority of U.S. adults are metabolically busted, up to 94%. I've been talking about this ad nauseum. You guys can go back through the 100-something podcasts that I've put up since 2021, and you can hear for yourself that I have been railing against the system at large. I do not love how these peptides are being prescribed in the conventional brand name form. I do not love how patients are being managed on them. I do not love how they are being handled as potentially weight loss drugs for vanity weight. But I have talked about all of this ad nauseum on my other podcast episodes, which I will link in the show notes. And I want you to go back and listen to those, please, because I think you're going to get a more nuanced discussion of what these peptides actually do and how they work inside the body. I also want to point you towards my free 4-part video training series called Ozempic Uncovered. And I'll make sure that the link is in the show notes. It's drtina.com/Ozempic Uncovered. You may have to put a www in front of that to make it work. It's a great video training series. In part one, I talk about beyond weight loss. I talk about the other implications that GLP-1 has shown in the data to have positively on our health and different organ systems of our bodies. And I think you might be shocked. Part two, I dispel the big scaries. So all the big scaries that you're hearing about, a few of them I'm going to address briefly today, but I want you to go listen to part two of that video training series so that you can hear all of it. And part three, I talk about how the dose makes the poison. High dosing these peptides as a monotherapy and not being part of a comprehensive treatment plan, I think is ridiculous, and it's going to lead to a lot of problems for people. I'm not saying there aren't severe gastrointestinal issues that happen at times, but I am telling you that it's being blown way out of proportion. And the whole thing is giving me a lot of ick. It reeks of 2020 COVID days. It reeks of COVIDians who just couldn't hear the truth no matter how much objective data you put in front of them. Their emotions were so tightly woven into the fabric of the narrative that they couldn't see past it. And I'm seeing the exact same thing happen with this. I also want to say to anyone who thinks that obesity is a character flaw, can pretty much just fuck off and get off this podcast, because I came from a family of all obese folks and it's not a character flaw. Now, is it a discipline issue? Is it a dietary habits issue? Is it an epigenetic issue? Are there issues with the offspring of women who go into pregnancy obese and diabetic? Yes, there's all of that. The genetic issues aren't necessarily a genetic propensity to be obese, but there is an epigenetic component of being obese. And those cards are dealt to those children in utero. And they are sitting ducks for obesity and metabolic dysfunction for the rest of their lives. And so are their offspring. If we don't actually end up going extinct as a species, because I really think that's where we're headed, to be quite honest with you. There is an issue with childhood obesity, and that the majority of children who are obese tend to have parents who are also obese. So it's not as simple as changing the food in schools or the snack machines in schools, the vending machines. I mean, yes, of course, all that would help. I'm not saying don't do it. Let's put dollars there. It's garbage. My daughter's 24 and the food she was being fed was garbage. The food I was being fed was bordering on garbage, and I'm 50 years old. I don't think kids should be eating that slop by any means. And we could do a whole lot better with the dollars that the taxpayers pay in this country. But all that said, these kids still have to go home and contend with what their parents are feeding them and contend with how their parents are choosing to live. So there's a lot to this that's very nuanced. It's very triggering for people. It's very emotional for people. There's a lot more to the obesity discussion that I'd love to get into, but that's not what this podcast is about. We will touch on that another day. I am gathering my notes and my thoughts about it because I know a lot of people who've gone down the pathway of obesity. I know several who have come back. It's nuanced. And it's not just a character flaw. It's not just because they're lazy. I'm so sick of some of the comments I'm seeing online. It's really grossing me out. I know back in 2020, I was gunning for people to wake up and realize that the state that they were living in, meaning the physical state that they were living in, whether it be an obese body, a metabolically dysfunctional body, that was going to make them more inclined to bad outcomes and poor outcomes with COVID. And it was really important for me that people understand the nuances of what was going on inside their bodies so that they could make themselves more resilient and so that they could actually have a fighting chance if and when COVID came knocking. And I got so much pushback on that and got called fatophobic and got called all kinds of names that I just think were really misconstrued, because at the end of the day, the messaging had nothing to do with how people got into an obese state. I was just simply trying to let people know that the powers that be were not really doing us a lot of favors in that they weren't giving us a lot of information about how we could fortify our bodies. If you embark on an insulin-sensitive, metabolically healthy lifestyle now, the changes that happen for you inside your body start very, very quickly. And it takes about 90 days for lab work to show up and show these changes, but the benefits start dramatically within the first week. And so I was simply trying to get folks over the past few years to wake up to the crisis we were in. It has become very unfashionable to talk about this topic. People on both sides get mad at me, whether I'm talking about the implications that come with longstanding obesity, whether I'm talking about type 2 diabetes, whether I'm talking about Ozempic. People get so mad and so fired up. And I get it. It's a very charged subject and people have emotions all over the place about it. All I'm trying to give you guys is the facts and let you know how it all trickles down in your health. The Health at Every Size movement is a hypothesis, and it's just not factually true either. But we cannot throw the baby out with the bathwater when it comes to GLP-1 agonists like Ozempic, Wegovy. Actually, everyone's railing on Ozempic, but Ozempic, just FYI, is the diabetes drug. No one seems to have a problem with the use of that. The problem people are having is actually with Wegovy, but they're using the term Ozempic because, just like I am, because it gets people's attention. It gets you to read. It gets you to pay attention and listen. And all I'm trying to simply do is let you know that there is a way to do this that's different. That's why I have created my program, Ozempic Done Right, which you can hear about at another time. There is a way to do this that allows people to not have any side effects or very minimal side effects. And I'm talking to so many doctors and clinicians that are doing it right and are doing it in a way that is part of a comprehensive treatment plan and is conducive to patient longevity and patient success. And patients aren't walking into these horrific side effects. But since these peptides have been on the market 20 years now, different versions of them, we only just started hearing about the dangers and how deadly it was and all of the terrors of it in the past couple years when the conversation started veering towards weight loss. And I think that's just gross. So there's a lot more I want to say about this. I'm not trying to defend Ozempic or Wegovy. I am defending this peptide, though, because it's a signaling peptide hormone, you guys. Just like any hormone, if you were to be put on crazy high doses of testosterone or thyroid or estrogen or anything like that, you'd feel terrible. You wouldn't blame the hormone. You'd blame the doctor who prescribed it. You'd blame the dosing strategy or the pharmaceutical company that suggested the dose be that high. Whenever any patient is having side effects from any drug, we pull them back on the dose. And for some reason, the lunacy of this is just to keep cranking up the dose and people start having terrible side effects, but some people don't. And these are not drugs also. Drugs sit on receptors and do things that change the way that the cell works. So pathways get blocked or pathways get pushed. Peptides are different. Peptides are actually just strings of amino acid that are naturally occurring in the body. Semaglutide is actually very closely resembling the natural GLP-1 inside of our bodies, which we cannot all stimulate. There's this misnomer that there's nature's Ozempic and that we can just crank some supplements and herbs and we'll just make all the GLP-1 we need. That is factually incorrect. Sometimes people's L cells are fried out because of longstanding leaky gut or gut issues or gut inflammation or aging or body-wide inflammation. Their L cells are petered out. You cannot stimulate them to go. So some people are actually mechanically GLP-1 deficient, and some people are genetically inclined to GLP-1 deficiencies, and other folks, including those, and we have the data on this, look it up. It's not a hard Google search. Those with fatty liver, obesity, and type 2 diabetes are known to have GLP-1 deficiencies. Is it chicken or egg? We don't know. Genetic mutations are showing up that will make somebody more inclined towards GLP-1 deficiency. So there's a lot to unpack here, and I'm trying to do it over a series of podcasts as best I can, but I'm getting met with so much venom and vitriol, and it's ridiculous. And the people that are coming at me do not have anything but emotions behind them, and they are factually incorrect. So with that, I'm going to jump into a few. First off, let's talk about suicidal ideation. There's been some speculation going around and some investigations by the EU about this peptide inducing, you know, potential thoughts that were not good. I'm not going to keep saying the word. I don't want to get in trouble on different platforms. But upon further investigation, the United States, at least the FDA, is not as concerned. So far as they have concluded thus far in their investigation, they're not concerned. They're not seeing it link up. The EU is still looking. But we do have some information. So during the period from January 1st, 2018 to July 10th, 2023, a total of 41,236 individual case safety reports related to GLP-1 receptor agonists were retrieved from this European database, of which 230 or 0.06 reported at least one suicidal event. Okay. So 230 out of 41,236. You can do the math on that. 0.6%. Not saying irrelevant, just telling you it's very low. Several studies show amelioration of depression and anxiety through their anti-inflammatory effects on the brain, however. Preliminary evaluation by the Food and Drug Administration did not find evidence that GLP-1 drugs like Ozempic and Wegovy cause suicidal thoughts or actions. The FDA's ongoing investigation has concluded, through looking at the FDA adverse event reporting system, that they're still looking into it, but did not demonstrate a clear relationship with the use of GLP-1 receptor agonists. Similarly, our reviews of the clinical trials, including large outcome studies and observational studies, did not find an association. So there's that. And I know we're still looking. And of course, every single episode or instance matters, and it's a life, and it's somebody struggling or somebody who went too far with things, unfortunately, and we have to keep looking. So they're continuing to look. Let's see. They did say the European Medicines Agency has also concluded, while they're still looking thus far, they've concluded that they haven't found a link. So that's where we are with that. And an NIH-funded analysis finds patients treated with semaglutide had 49% to 73% lower risk of suicidal ideation than those given other medications. So they were comparing other weight loss medications to semaglutide. And just for the audience listening, weight loss, if it's too rapid, can actually induce a very depressed state in a patient, because a lot of our hormones are in our fat cells, especially in our tummy area. We carry a lot of estrogen and progesterone, and losing weight too fast can really put people into a downward tailspin. So there's issues with fast weight loss, and that's the issue I have with high doses of these peptides, where people's appetites are being crushed and they're being put into basically an anorexic state, and their weight is falling off of them too fast while they're probably not eating very nourishing, high macronutrient, high micronutrient foods, not nutrient dense foods, and they're having issues that way. So is it the peptide or is it the severe and rapid weight loss? Hard to say, right? But it's easy to just blame the peptide here. So that's where we're at with that. You can find that study in Nature, which is a very well-respected medical journal, and I will link it in the show notes. A recent observational study in Nature Medicine, though, found that there was a lower risk of suicidal ideations linked to GLP-1s than for other obesity and diabetes treatments. So that's the conclusion on that. There is actually dopamine signaling that is involved when it comes to GLP-1s in the brain and how they work. And so there's an HPA axis stimulation and there's some dopaminergic impacts, and we don't exactly know how it all works, but that could be good or bad for people. And it really depends on how their brain chemistry works. So just like anything, we do not prescribe things and then leave people on their own and say good luck. We manage our patients. We manage them closely and we make sure that they're doing okay whenever we start them on something new. And we check in with them frequently and we make sure that everything's okay. If you have a doctor who's not doing that, then find a new doctor. It's not the peptide's fault. It's being managed wrong. I've said this repeatedly. It's a dosage and management issue. So GLP-1 medications have been found to indirectly modify the release of dopamine in the amygdala by producing neural circuits involved in the regulation of dopamine release. What that means is, and why it's important, is because your amygdala is part of your lizard brain and it's the seat of emotion. There's a lot that goes on in the amygdala. And I think it's very exciting that we can impact the amygdala. And I think it's an opportunity, especially because we know these peptides have a neuroregenerative effect and an anti-inflammatory effect in the brain. That leads me to believe that there's a large potential for neuroplasticity. So if we're actually in an active state of neuroplasticity, then I think it's very exciting. This is potential opportunity to have a gateway or window into really helping patients learn new healthy behaviors, right? Okay, so there's that. Let's put that one to bed. Another big claim that I'm hearing is, and a lot of people are upset about this, is this claim that the American Academy of Pediatrics has recently come out with their new guidelines, and people are making these bold, blatant, incorrect, factually incorrect statements saying that, oh, the American Academy of Pediatrics is pushing GLP-1s as first-line therapy. That's the lie. That's the lie I keep hearing. On multiple occasions, I've had people say, well, the American Academy of Pediatrics said this, and they're saying that GLP-1s are first-line therapy for obese children. I'm not even going to get into the nuances of what obesity does to a child, but I will tell you, it's not great, and living with it is not great. Again, though, I'm not defending Ozempic as a first-line therapy, but that said, that is factually incorrect. That is not what the recommendations are. It is not what the guidelines say. The guidelines actually emphasize lifestyle management first and foremost. They talk about diet and exercise and lifestyle interventions and educating the parents and doing a whole lot of things before you get to pharmacologic intervention. But pharmacologic intervention is in there because their watch and wait strategy is not working. Watching and waiting has just led us into a significant childhood obesity issue in this country. And so the guidelines do not say jump on GLP-1s first and foremost. They do not say take Ozempic right away. They actually say intervene with the things that we know. Exercise, get these kids moving. I've watched webinar after webinar on this, you guys, from adults to children and what the guidelines are. Get these kids moving, get the adults moving, get everybody moving as best we can, first and foremost. Dietary interventions, some level of caloric restriction. Do all the things first. They talk about this. The doctors are not evil entities out there. They actually care. These associations actually do have something somewhat intelligent coming out of their mouths. And yet we're just so prone to vilifying them and just trashing on it. And I just think it's ridiculous. I'll give you some key statements, some key action statements that guide physicians on how to evaluate children and teens for obesity. Comprehensive obesity treatment may include nutrition support, physical activity treatment, behavioral therapy, pharmacotherapy, and metabolic and bariatric surgery. Now, I realize the pharmacotherapy and metabolic and bariatric surgery are severe, and those are severe cases, but intensive health behavior and lifestyle treatment is first and foremost, and it's challenging to deliver and not universally available. That's the problem. A lot of what these kids need and what adults need is not universally available for people to have access to. And the most effective treatments include 26 or more hours of face-to-face, family-based, multi-component treatment over a 3 to 12 month period. That's just not doable for most families, and it's not an option or available in many places. And so they talk about making sure trained healthcare professionals are active with a parent or caregiver and that the involvement is there and that these kids are being treated first and foremost with lifestyle, but they may actually need some pharmacologic and or bariatric intervention. I'm not going to argue either side of that. I'm just telling you what the guidelines say. But they don't say jump on Ozempic first. That is factually incorrect. Now let's talk about the gastrointestinal side effects. Conveniently, in October of 2022, a study came out called The Gastrointestinal Adverse Events Associated with Semaglutide, a pharmacovigilance study based on FDA Adverse Event Reporting System. So they looked at the Adverse Event Reporting System of the FDA, and this is what they came up with. Reporting odds ratio was employed to qualify the signals of semaglutide-related gastrointestinal adverse events from 2018 to 2022, all right? So they looked at it over a period of 4 years there. 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. Serious and non-serious cases were compared, and the signals were prioritized using a rating scale. The results, we identified 5,442 cases of semaglutide-associated gastrointestinal adverse events with 45 signals detected, and I'm going to break it down for you. They actually found these 5,442 patients that had 11,326 adverse events. So we're going to go off the 11,326 events And that's what these percentages are based off of. This is off of a chart that's in the study. I'll put the link in the show notes. You guys can read it. I've been a low-carb gal for a long time, and I'm embarrassed to admit that I've only recently learned in the past few years that all low-carb folks should know is how critically important electrolytes are to supplement. Electrolytes facilitate hundreds of functions in the body, including the conduction of nerve impulses, hormonal regulation, nutrient absorption, and fluid balance. Common issues like headaches, muscle cramps, fatigue, sleeplessness may simply be a lack of electrolytes. Adequate electrolyte intake can boost performance and recovery in the gym as well. And most importantly, they support the low-carb lifestyle that many of us follow. My new favorite electrolyte product is by Element. Element is a tasty electrolyte drink mix with everything you need and nothing you don't. This means a science-backed electrolyte ratio with none of the junk, no sugar, no coloring, no artificial ingredients, no gluten, no fillers, no BS. Simply adding a daily packet of Element into my routine has given me more energy, less cramping, and improved mood overall. I even think it's helping my sleep. I've teamed up with Element, and they've been gracious enough to offer a free gift with purchase to listeners of the Dr. Tina Show. The free gift Element sample pack includes one packet of every flavor. This is the perfect gift for anyone who's interested in trying all of their flavors. My favorite is the raspberry salt. They offer a no questions asked refund on all orders, so if you don't like it, you don't even have to send it back. This offer is exclusively available to Dr. Tina Show listeners, so be sure to use the link in the show notes and take advantage of it now. Head to the link drinkelement.com/Dr. Tina. That's drinkelement.com/Dr. Tina. Whether you're trying to lose weight, add more muscle, or simply stay as hot as possible for as long as possible in middle age, Keon Aminos helps prevent muscle loss, which ultimately helps prevent many of the cardinal signs of aging. You know my biggest non-negotiable is that we need to protect our lean muscle mass for optimized metabolism and hormones as we age. Muscle is the ticket to a faster, more efficient metabolism for the long haul. The challenge is twofold for us silver foxes. First, the process of aging makes maintaining our muscle not only so much harder, but we actually have to fight to keep it on. Second, maintaining muscle can be very challenging when you're trying to lose fat. You see, when you cut calories, regardless of how you go about it, you lose fat and muscle unless you're actively working to protect it. Keon Aminos can help here. Keon Aminos helps prevent muscle loss and helps you feel fuller when in a caloric deficit. I'm a notorious undereater, so I'm sure to take several scoops of Keon Aminos daily to best protect and service the muscle I work so hard for in the gym. With Keon Aminos, I definitely notice improved strength as well as better body composition. Keon Aminos contain all 9 essential amino acids necessary for muscle protein synthesis in ideal ratios, proven by over 20 years of research. Branched-chain amino acids, for instance, have only 3, and some other brands only have 8. Their transparent formula contains exact amounts of each amino acid given, not a proprietary blend, and they have a risk-free 60-day money-back guarantee, so you can't go wrong. So get yourself some Keon Aminos and go lift some heavy shit. Muscle is non-negotiable. Protect it with Keon Aminos. To save 20% on Keon Aminos, just go to getkeon.com/Dr. Tina. That's getkeon.com/DRTYNA. Traditionally, if you look up in any doctor's software, any prescribing software, any, just do a Google search and just put in nausea rates with Ozempic. Just put that into Google. But if you want to, you're going to find that the numbers correlate with the software that I have access to as a physician. The going data shows 1 in 5 will have nausea. The bold statement I heard recently was 80% of users have chronic nausea. That's actually factually incorrect. And in fact, the study that I'm talking about here interestingly found that most of the side effects went away pretty quickly and they did not remain. So 80% of users having chronic nausea is a bold-faced lie. The going data shows 1 in 5, which would be 20%. So 20% is a whole lot different than 80%. This study, out of 11,329 adverse events, 2,369 had nausea. That's 21%. Out of that 21%, 23% were serious and 77% were not so serious. So 21%, this study is showing that's on par with what the rest of the data is showing and all the other studies are showing. So I'm going to just go around 20%. We can even be generous and say 20 to 25% of people experience nausea, but most of the studies show that this nausea goes away over time. And that is what I'm finding clinically as well. Vomiting. Boldface lie that I'm seeing going around. 30% of users experience frequent vomiting. That's bullshit. I don't know where that study or that data is coming from. I'd love to see it for whoever said it. The going data shows 5 to 10% have vomiting. And this study showed 10.5%. So out of that 10.5%, 39% were serious, 73% were not serious. So 10.5% are experiencing vomiting. Pancreatitis, that's another one I hear about all the time. I do not know where this is coming from because the SELECT trial, which was a large study that just concluded showing really remarkable results with cardiovascular disease. Interestingly, the control group had more pancreatitis than the semaglutide group, but I digress. In this study, they had 389 cases of pancreatitis out of 11,329 adverse events, so 3%. Of that 3%, most of it was serious because pancreatitis is very serious. So I'm not discounting that pancreatitis is happening. I absolutely acknowledge that it is. But the weird thing that's happening online is anytime anyone posts anything about Ozempic, a bunch of people jump into the comment section and say, my friend had pancreatitis, my mom had pancreatitis, all these pancreatitis that seemingly happen. I'll tell you how pancreatitis happens. And I go over this in detail in part two of my video training series that's free that you can access via the link in this show notes. You throw a gallstone into the pancreas. Gallstones are super common when people are overweight. They're more prone to gallstones. But when you go on a low calorie diet and you stop eating, which I'm not suggesting people dose up high enough to go into complete caloric deficit like that. But when it happens, your gallbladder bile gets sludgy. And if you're prone to stones, which many people who are obese are, you will potentially throw a stone. And the number one cause of pancreatitis is a stone out of the gallbladder. No one's talking about that part though. So if you're sitting on the edge of gallstones, and a lot of people going into using these peptides probably already have a lot of gallstones just based on their physiology of the larger size body or the diabetic body, that they're throwing a stone into the pancreas and they're getting pancreatitis. It's not like the pancreas is just randomly melting down. That's not generally how this works. And it's such a low rate that I'm not sure where all these people in the comment section are coming from, but I digress. It feels a little COVID-y, like the COVID days when I would see the same things in the comment section and it was clear bots were doing it or people were just coming in and railing and they all sounded the same. They were all parroting the same thing. So I don't know. I don't know. I'm just speculating. I've looked through a ton of data. I've combed the data. And you know who's at most risk for pancreatitis with GLP-1 agonists? The rats. The rats that were given crazy high doses of semaglutide got pancreatitis. And that's not what we're seeing in humans. But if you're seeing a ton of pancreatitis as a clinician, then I'm not really sure what's going on. You shouldn't be. You're either not picking your patients right, you're not managing them right, or you're dosing too high. And I'm going to leave it at that. This study that I'm referring to, this is the words from the study. This study provided the latest findings of semaglutide-related gastrointestinal safety profiles by post-marketing based on real-world population from the FAERS database. Although our results were consistent with previous clinical trials and literature reviews that semaglutide might increase the risk of gastrointestinal disorders, our report presented a more accurate and detailed description and characterization of gastrointestinal adverse events spectrum of semaglutide to date, which innovatively added stratification analysis, clinical priority of signals, and the serious outcomes. Interestingly, in the study, patients over 100 kilograms reported more gastrointestinal adverse events than those that were under 80 and 80 to 100 kilograms. So the heavier set people, maybe they were on higher doses, but obesity will make you more prone to a lot of the adverse events you're hearing about with the GLP-1 agonist. So I speculate that a lot of these folks are just sitting on the edge of already having these problems, and then they're getting slammed with high doses of a GLP-1 agonist, and they're getting pushed over the edge. Anyway, There's that information. Hence, the association between semaglutide and gastrointestinal disorders remained when stratified by body weight. So yes, they're real. They're happening. I don't think they're happening at the numbers that we're hearing about, but I will let you decide. Another study out of JAMA showed a hazard ratio of 9 with pancreatitis, 900% increase. Bowel obstruction, 422% increase. Gastroparesis, 367% increase. Those are staggering and concerning. And if you scale that to, you know, many more users, then we're going to see those rates be significant, right? But let me just give you the actual numbers here. So they looked at the semaglutide group versus liraglutide, which is an older version of GLP-1, versus bupropion naltrexone. They didn't have a control group. They were just comparing folks who were on weight loss drugs to folks who were on other weight loss drugs. Okay, so all these folks were on weight loss drugs. In the semaglutide group, 613 patients, biliary disease showed up in 2%, pancreatitis showed up in 0.75% or 4.6. 4.6 people out of 613, still 4.6 people dealing with something terrible. I'm not discounting it. Bowel obstruction, zero. Zero people in the semaglutide group had bowel obstruction. And gastroparesis, which by the way is transient and goes away when you discontinue the peptide. It takes a few weeks to get it out of your system, but this is not a permanent condition. 1.5% or 9.1 people. Nine people out of 613 got gastroparesis. Now that's still a decent amount of people to be concerned about, but not enough to, I mean, when you put it in context to these hazard ratios, the hazard ratios get a whole lot less scary. And I'll say this before I go on. This is up to risk tolerance. If somebody's living with obesity and diabetes, the clinical outcomes for them in the long run are devastating. And there's just no way around that. They're looking at losing toes, eyes, kidneys, life of dialysis, if the heart disease doesn't catch them first. Heart disease, stroke. If that doesn't get them, they're going to get Alzheimer's and dementia. So you got to pick your risk tolerance. And I'm not saying everyone has the risk tolerance, but if you are listening to this and you're one of the people that are just railing on Ozempic and you are a, you know, somebody of low body fat and you don't have type 2 diabetes, first of all, you don't live in these people's bodies and you have absolutely no idea what they're dealing with. And second of all, you don't have the same risk tolerance because you don't have anything at stake because you're not worried about it. But these folks might have a lot at stake and maybe these numbers are not as concerning to them. And potentially dosed correctly, these wouldn't even be happening, right? These are coming from much higher doses than I'm ever comfortable giving people. And I monitor my patients very carefully, as do all the people, all the clinicians I know using GLP-1 agonists. None of them are reporting any side effects anywhere near this, maybe a little nausea or vomiting, and you back the dose down. This isn't rocket science. The liraglutide group had a bit more concerning numbers, but that's an older generation GLP-1, and that's not what I'm using here. I lied. I take that back. Looking at this again, out of 4,144 people, 18 of them had biliary disease, 7.9 of them had pancreatitis, so eight of them out of over 4,000. Eight of them had bowel obstruction out of over 4,000, and seven of them had gastroparesis out of over 4,000. So yes, those are real cases and those are concerning, but go look at the data around statin drugs and all the other drugs that people are on every day that you're not giving anybody any shit about. Those drugs also have terrible side effect profiles in the long term. Now, interestingly, the bupropion naltrexone group, now this is Wellbutrin mixed with naltrexone, this is comparable to the semaglutide group in size. Let's say both of them were around 600. Semaglutide had 600 people, bupropion naltrexone had 650. The semaglutide group, like I said, had 11.7 with biliary disease. The bupropion naltrexone had 12.6 with biliary disease. Guess who gets biliary disease? People suffering with obesity. It's not uncommon. I've said that earlier. The pancreatitis group was 1 in the naltrexone group, the bupropion naltrexone group, and it was 4.6 in the semaglutide group. So 4.6 people. Bowel obstruction was 1 in the bupropion naltrexone group, and it was 0 in the semaglutide group. And gastroparesis was 3.1 in the bupropion group and 9.1 in the semaglutide group. bupropion naltrexone doesn't slow gastric emptying, but semaglutide does. So you're going to get more GI impacts with something that's actually impacting the bowels like that. The black box warning on cancer, on thyroid cancer, I'm just going to say this. I'm not discounting the black box warning, you guys. I understand that's worth noting. However, that black box warning was not on humans. It was on rats. It was on rats given crazy high doses. Rats also developed this very rare type of medullary thyroid cancer spontaneously, by the way. I've had pet rats. Anyone else had pet rats? I've had many pet rats. And guess what? They get crazy cancers. They get crazy cancers just spontaneously on their bodies. The control group of rats also got these cancers spontaneously erupting, by the way. And we don't have any human data that's causative. We have no human data showing causation with thyroid cancers. I'm not saying throw the black box warning out or throw all caution to the wind and say, who cares? Talk to your doctor. If you have a family history or a personal history of thyroid cancer, medullary thyroid cancer, work with a smart clinician and make sure that you're being careful and you guys can decide together what your risk tolerance is and what you're gonna do. I'm not counseling you on that. I just wanna let you know that even the Cleveland Clinic said we do not have enough data to conclude that GLP-1s are causing thyroid cancer. So looking at all the data, we have some correlative studies. And also, guess who's most prone to thyroid cancer? Folks who are obese have a 2x risk, and folks with type 2 diabetes have a 1.5x risk. Higher rates of thyroid cancer. So we're looking at a group prone to a lot of these gastrointestinal issues. We're looking at a group prone to thyroid cancer, and then we're wondering, is it the semaglutide, or was it just the natural course of events for these people? It's hard to say. We don't have the data on that yet. There's a couple other untrue things I'd like to address. We're hearing a lot that 1/3 of patients are going off, and it's being touted like they went off voluntarily because they were so miserable they couldn't handle it. We don't actually have that data to show that. There's a lot of reasons why people go off. I have hundreds of thousands of followers across different platforms, and I hear from a lot of them, and many of them are reporting to me, I was on a GLP-1 agonist, it was life-changing, and then I had to go off because my insurance stopped paying. That's a really common scenario I'm hearing about. There's a lot of reasons why somebody might go off these. Maybe they don't like giving themselves shots. Maybe they couldn't handle the high dosage that the doctor was recommending because the standard of care really ramps these up fast and high. And I think it's nuts. I think it's nutso. So perhaps they did go off of it because they couldn't tolerate it. But that's like me saying, oh, you were given 10x the dose of thyroid that I think you should be on. And because you were having tachycardia and felt horrible, you went off of it. It must be the peptide. It's like, no, it was the dose, because a tiny little bit of thyroid hormone might change that person's life significantly, right? It might be just groundbreaking and amazing. So it's apples to oranges here. And some of these statistics you're hearing thrown around are just, first of all, I don't know, made up garbage, but also we're not looking at the nuance behind it. And we're not really assessing why maybe 1/3 of these people went off. What about the other 2/3 that are having profound and amazing life-changing effects? Because they wouldn't have stayed on it if they weren't loving it, right? So it's, I mean, there's me speculating, but that's what's happening. There's a lot of speculation going on. I've also heard that it's a starvation diet. That is incorrect. Nothing could be more incorrect than that. These are peptides that heal your tissue. They have been shown to have regenerative properties in the pancreas. They make your insulin receptors more sensitive. They decrease visceral fat. Think of them as resetting your metabolic health. They reset your metabolism over time and they heal you. It's not just they make you not hungry and they slow down your gut emptying and that's it. The other argument I'm hearing is, well, they make you secrete insulin. Isn't that bad? Aren't we already dealing with too much insulin? There's two factors here we have to talk about. One is folks who are type 2 diabetic are actually somewhat insulin deficient at that point. By the time they get there, their insulin production is petering out. Their pancreas is like, oh, especially if they've been at it long term. Their pancreas is having a rough time producing the insulin. But more importantly, on the other side of the signaling pathway, the cells are becoming resistant because they are also tired and their mitochondria are petering out and the whole system is crashing. I've said this before. If you get diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, you've been rocking metabolic dysfunction for a decade or more. And that is a very severe case of metabolic dysfunction. It is a very bad place to be. Do not take it casually. If your doctor says, oh, you're type 2 diabetic, that should set off alarms. Like metabolically, things have really fallen off the rails. And that's going to take a lot to get it back. GLP-1s actually heal that whole pathway in a multitude of ways by helping out with the AMPK pathway, with helping out with the POMC neurons. It stimulates both, with making leptin and ghrelin more sensitive, with helping muscle. It actually induces muscle protein synthesis. It does not make you lose muscle mass, you guys. That's a whole other conversation, but that is a myth and it is incorrect. If people are strength training and they're prioritizing protein, nobody's losing any muscle. Anyone who goes on a severely calorically restricted diet is going to lose muscle. That just happens. The other thing that they're not talking about that I haven't heard anyone mention is that folks with diabetes and metabolic dysfunction and obesity have really pathologic muscle, and their muscle is marbled. It's highly marbled. So take a prime rib and put it next to a filet mignon, not a fatty filet mignon, a very non-fatty filet mignon. If we just counted muscle cells, I'm going to guess they have the same amount. There's the same amount of meat there. The prime rib just has a ton of marbling and fat. And so you get a big slab, right? But the actual amount of meat, the actual amount of muscle cells present is probably higher actually in the filet mignon. So imagine a big slab of muscle that's all prime rib and cut of meat that's prime rib, and you've melted all the fat off, because that's what improving metabolic health does. It makes you lose the marbling in your muscle. The mass of that is going to shrink significantly because there wasn't a lot of muscle there to begin with. There was just a lot of fatty infiltrate in that muscle. But all they're measuring in this data is mass. All they're measuring when they put you on these monitors is mass. And so if you don't have well-trained skeletal muscle to begin with, then it's going to look like you're losing a lot of muscle mass. But really, potentially, I believe they're probably just losing a lot of the fat marbling. And also, you are going to lose, pound for pound, you're going to lose a little bit of muscle. I actually haven't lost any. I'm on such a tiny dose, though, that it's not impacting me that way. I haven't lost any strength either, but focusing on strength really is more important. I'm more concerned with how your muscle works. If you're losing strength, then we need to be concerned, but we also have to take that into context. We're losing strength in comparison to, as a percentage, right? It's like if I'm 155 pounds and I can deadlift 200 pounds, but then I lose 20 pounds of body weight overall, whether that be fat and muscle, then I'm at a lower weight and I probably can't pull 200 pounds anymore just as easily. But can I, as a percentage of my body weight, still pull that? And the answer right now is yes, because I continue to strength train. So if you're prioritizing muscle and protecting your muscle, and you're being counseled correctly and managed correctly by your physician, and your physician also lifts weights and they're aware of the importance of this, then the muscle loss really isn't the issue. It does that they're making it out to be. But if you crank up the peptide, you put yourself into a crash diet, you restrict calories because you're not hungry because the peptide dose is so high that it's crushing your appetite, well, then we're going to have some problems. But there's a few other ways that muscle is actually protected from GLP-1s, and I talk about that inside my four-part video series. It's part two in there. You'll get it on the second day after you go. Share your email with me. You'll immediately get sent part one, and then part two will come to you the next morning. So you can opt in for that and hear all about that. I have a new favorite skincare product that I'm loving, and I wanted to tell you about it. It's called Angel Mist, and it's by Alatura Naturals. Angel Mist smells heavenly as it's infused with delicate fragrances of rose, lang lang, and blue lotus. And it's a unique blend of Hawaiian purified water, witch hazel extract, rose hydrosol, and other amazing ingredients, including caffeine and niacinamide. One of my favorite aspects of Angel Mist is how it helps balance oil production on my skin via the retinol-like Egyptian Nile flower. I combo it with my other favorite Alatura natural products. After using the Pearl Cleanser, I spray with the Angel Mist, apply the gold serum, and let it soak in. Then I spray again with the Angel Mist and apply the night cream. The hydrosols in Angel Mist help the oils absorb into the skin. I also use it to set my makeup and to refresh my skin throughout the day. I've even used it with the famous Alatura clay mask. You can save 20% off Angel Mist right now by heading to alitura.com and using Dr. Tina at checkout. That's alitura.com and code Dr. Tina for 20% off your entire order. No sustained weight loss. That is incorrect. So let's break this down. I've got some interesting information here, and I will leave you with this. So the studies, even the big studies, are showing that when people go off of these, they gain 2/3 of their weight back. And some claims that I've seen online say it enables weight loss by decreasing muscle, not fat, which is bullshit and incorrect, which is devastating to health. That is incorrect. Another one was Ozempic makes you fatter. That is also incorrect. It does not. It actually induces visceral fat loss, which some studies have shown to be overall body mass index wise, much more significant to health outcomes, losing the visceral fat than the small amount of muscle that might be lost. I cannot deal with these untruths anymore. It's ridiculous. I don't know where people are getting these. I think they're getting their headlines from the Daily Mail. I don't know, but it's just factually incorrect. You do not end up fatter in the end. Now, if you don't protect your muscle and you keep eating garbage and you lose a ton of weight, yes, you're going to lose muscle mass. And then if you gain weight back, which a lot of people are in many of these studies, some showing 2/3 of people gaining the weight back, you're going to gain all fat back. And then you're going to be left in a much more metabolically busted state. However, we thought all of that until recently. This is very interesting. This was on Axios. Many patients keep weight off after stopping anti-obesity meds. This is a study. Most patients on the new class of anti-obesity medications kept off at least some of the weight up to a year after they stopped taking the medication, according to new data from Epic Research. And I will link this in the show notes so you can look at it. Why this matters is that it appears to contradict previous studies that have indicated patients on drugs such as GLP-1 agonists need to stay on them to keep the weight off. So this misnomer that you have to stay on them for life, it is incorrect. I'm hearing from doctors all over the place using these correctly that they're not finding that to be true. But Epic says its findings from nearly 40,000 patient records across 236 health systems are consistent with those previous studies, but it said the new research offers a more nuanced picture of patient outcomes. They also included patients prescribed the drugs for diabetes and not just weight loss. The drug's long-term benefits appear more favorable when examined in this larger population and more granular data. Researchers looked at weight loss up to 12 months out from patients stopping the use of liraglutide or semaglutide, and basically what they found that nearly 20% of patients regained all the weight they had lost or more in the 12 months after stopping the drug, and another 26% regained more than a quarter of their original weight, but were short of the total regain. Okay, so there's some numbers. That lines up more with the studies I've read. About 20% of patients essentially maintained their weight loss, meaning they didn't regain or lose more than a quarter of their weight. So 20% had success. And more than 1 in 3 patients continued to lose weight in the 12 months after stopping the drug because they used that time while they were on it to learn new lifestyle habits and implement new strategies to keep their body weight lower. So the point again is that it's nuanced. And I'm telling you, the doctors that I've been talking to who are using these peptides correctly are telling me that people are not regaining the weight so long as we use that time. Like I said, it gives the onus of control back to the patient and their metabolism is healing and regenerating. And so if folks use that time to implement new strategies, new habits, new dietary habits, new exercise habits, or at least double down on the ones they're currently doing, that 20% of patients essentially maintain their weight loss and 1 in 3 continue to lose weight. So it's not what you're being told. These blatantly incorrect pseudo facts that are being spread around the internet have got to go. And hopefully, I will make sure I have all the links in here for you. Hopefully, this has been somewhat eye-opening for you. And hopefully you will look at this with a little discretion because, man, people are so emotionally fired up about this. And I'm not defending the peptide even. I just cannot get behind trashing on an entire class of medications that are having profound and helpful impacts on people all over the world right now. I have never seen in my several decades in medicine, I have never seen anything that could be dosed, when done correctly, so low and so effectively address so many different health issues that a patient is having. And I am patient first. I am here to put the patient in front of me in the best situation that they can be in. And I will use every tool available to me. And I have a license to prescribe, and I'm not afraid to use it when needed. I love peptides. I love that they heal. I love that they regenerate tissue. I love that they go in and do the job they need to do. And going back to, just to close, where I said earlier that these peptides increase insulin and people are having a fit about that. The second part to that is that, so part one was that it actually makes insulin sensitivity. It does not cause the patient to go into a hyperdrive insulin state. It just helps the body respond properly when signals should be heard and they're not being heard in the type 2 diabetic or the obese state. It allows that whole cascade to go on correctly. And again, it's regenerative and healing to the entire process. So I will leave it at that. I have a 4-part video series I would love for you guys to check out. It's drtina.com/Ozempic Uncovered. I'll make sure to have the link in the show notes. I would absolutely love if you guys would check it out. Even if you hated everything I just said and this has made you really angry, go listen to it anyway, because we need facts over fear. I'm so tired of this new science since 2020 where people just scream louder than the other one and then they win and facts are just thrown out the window and science gets discarded. We really need to start taking a nuanced look at things. Nothing happens in a silo. Nothing is black and white as they want to make it out to be. And these peptides are helping a lot of people and I think have the potential to change the world if done correctly. So I will leave you with the free video training series. And if you have any questions or you'd like to hear me talk more on this topic, email me podcast@drtina.com and I will be sure to check out your requests. Thanks so much. Thanks for listening to the Dr. Tina Show. Please be sure to follow me on Instagram at Dr. Tina, that's DRTYNA, and Dr. Tina 2.0, as well as visit my website at drtina.com. This is a Resonant Media production produced by Drake Peterson and mixed by Chris McCone. The theme song is by John the Gilt. As always, you can email the show at podcast@drtina.com. And if you like this episode, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast app. See you next week. This podcast is for general informational purposes only. It does not constitute the practices of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice. I am a doctor, but I am not your doctor. No doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of this information and the materials linked to this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content on this podcast is intended not to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice from any medical condition they have, and they should seek the assistance of their healthcare professionals for any such conditions.